You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and with me is my co-host, psychologist, Dr. Melody Fox.
Each week, we bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future.
And we will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many great ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually healthy.
With each of us having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, we have both been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us.
And we will continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, our topic today is coach your family to win. And I certainly believe that most of us could use someone to help with our focus at times. And there are many excellent coaches out there that can really help. Unfortunately, with the state of the economy, many people feel that they either don't have the money or the time to do so.
Well, our guests may have come up with an answer to those arguments, as well as how we can apply tested and winning principles to coaching our families to win as well. Our guest today is Howard M. Gutman. He is the principal of Gutman Development Strategies, Inc., a New Jersey-based management consulting firm founded in 1989 and specializing in executive coaching, building horizontal, high-performance teams, strategic and organizational alignment, and management development training. Now, the firm's clients include Colgate, Palmolive, John Hancock, Johnson & Johnson, L'Oreal USA, Mars, Inc., and Walmart, and so many more, and I'm so thrilled that he's here.
Well, and Mr. Gutman is the author of Great Business Teams, Cracking the Code for Standout Performance, and When Goliaths Clash, Managing Executive Conflict to Build a More Dynamic Organization. His third book, Coach Yourself to Win, 7 Steps to Breakthrough Performance on the Job and in Your Life, was named the Washington Post list of top 5 business books in April of 2011. Mr. Gutman, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you very much.
Well, we are both
good to be here.
Well, it's thrilling to have you here. You are so successful. You've helped so many executives and companies in helping them to win and to move forward with their job performance. But I really love your new book because it opens it up not only to those in the business world, but those in everyday life.
Yes, well, that actually was the point of the book. We wanted to take a look at how we could take the lessons from the corporate sector and how people could apply them to their life, whether it be losing weight, stopping smoking, creating stronger relationships with their family. So that was really the goal here, was to have it be a crossover book, mm-hmm. exactly as you said.
Well, how do you adopt the process that is used to coach executives? How do you make that work for parents and children? Or do you?
Well, you know, the thing is, if you look at the corporate world right now, the companies will really only spend money on the top of the house players, as they call it, the C-suite players, in terms of executive coaching. In a time of economic scarcity, what they're not doing is playing out, applying funds to people below that. So the reality here is that when you look at executive coaching, it is very much a process. What we did essentially was take a look at how do you replicate that process so that an individual in the company at a middle level or a level lower than that can do it, and then how can you do it also in your personal life. So probably the easiest way for me to help explain this would be to go through what the process looks like, and then we can really apply it to how someone would do it in their family,
mm-hmm. Well,
if that would work for you.
Absolutely. So, please do.
Yeah, so the first step really is, which sounds unusual, but really the first step is to determine what is your own coachability. I mean, in other words, when we work in organizations and we're qualifying clients, who we will work with, who we will not work with, the first question is to what degree somebody is coachable. In other words, to what degree is somebody willing to be vulnerable enough to allow someone to hold up a mirror to them and give them a perspective on what they're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at a family scenario, and I can think of my own wife and my own three children, even though you would think it's probably one of the safest places to be vulnerable because you're with people that, at least on paper, can't fire you, the reality here also is that you have this family dynamic that's gone on for so long. And so for a lot of individuals, being vulnerable, letting down the wall, allowing siblings or parents or children to provide you with feedback, for a lot of people is very daunting.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing we talk about in the book is really around how does someone manifest coachability? In other words, how does someone enable their family to feel like it's safe for them to be able to provide feedback? That's actually the first challenge.
Okay.
So how do you do that?
Well, it goes really down to the fact that people need to be able to depersonalize feedback. When I think about the work we do in the corporate sector or the work we do in executive coaching, someone's ability to depersonalize feedback and have it focus on behaviors is one of the crucial things that enables someone to demonstrate coachability. So in other words, if you were providing me with feedback around the fact that you felt that I was, let's say, not timely, or that I was not to be always relied upon, as opposed to me coming back trying to explain why, justifying a set of circumstances, if I came back to you and said, that's interesting, could you elaborate on that? Or if I said to you, well, it would be helpful for me if you gave me examples of where I went off the rails, blah, blah, blah. So in other words, as opposed to defending, if you're coming from a place of questioning and an openness, it will increase the likelihood that somebody will be willing to give you feedback. So that issue of demonstrating a level of openness to not defend, but be willing to hear it, is really the first step in creating a relationship where people can be a mutual in terms of providing and giving feedback.
Well, I would imagine that would be hard for some family members to trust that too, based on possible past experiences with that person and their behaviors and their reactions. So how do you think they would go about developing that trust, or would it just be an honest conversation saying, look, I know I've gotten upset in the past, I really would like to make some changes, and I'm willing to listen to what you have to say about me?
Yeah, well, you know, it stems from having an intention to take your game to another level. So another way to put that would be that you'd almost have to think about what would a happy ending look like,
mm-hmm.
and then rewind the tape to take a look at what part you would need to play to create that. So in other words, if we're in a family dynamic and I'm having an issue with my sister, to be able to acknowledge that and say, listen, I know that sometimes we have a rocky road. My goal here is to create like a different level of relationship between us. So I'd like to explore what that could look like. I would like to go out to lunch, go out to dinner, and let's take a look at what we may have done in the past that created the breakdown and what we could do going forward that could help to sustain a stronger level of closeness. So it really stems from initially putting out some type of intention, some statement of desire, an aspiration. So that really, to me, is the first thing that needs to be done, because then you're trying to like reset another level of engagement.
Well, you know, I noticed in your book, you mention it a lot, and you keep going back to it, and you just mentioned it here, but you wrote that the key to a behavior change, whether in business or family, is to clearly set an intention. Would you explain what is an intention and how does it differ from a simple goal, or if there's a difference?
Yeah, an intention, as I said before, it's almost like describing what would an end state look like if it were working,
mm-hmm.
and then you kind of like step into that behavior. So when I think of an intention, I think of it as far more impactful, far more three-dimensional than just a specific goal itself. So in other words, when I think about an intention, like an intention to be a better father, an intention to be a better husband, to be a better brother, and what you then do from that is start thinking about, what would that look like in terms of behaviors? What would that look like in terms of the dynamic around you? What would you be seeing? What would you be feeling? So you're setting basically a new context. It's like a three-dimensional context. And the old line, which I always agreed with, is that context creates content. content is attracted to context. So without creating, I'm getting over a cold. That's why I'm, my voice is not usually this sexy and robust. But what I was going to say, though, is that if you create a context, that becomes the portal to then attract the right type of behaviors. Mm-hmm. That's a much different game than just coming up with a simplistic goal. So that's why when I say intention, I'm saying, what is your aspiration? And then trying to deep dive into, how would I be feeling that? What would I be seeing? What would it look like? How would people experience me? So you're really trying to literally draw a picture of another way of being. Mm-hmm. Then the question then is, what would be the literal behaviors you need to start to demonstrate in order to have that be manifested? That'd probably be the best way to explain it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then tell us a little bit about an intention-busting stories. I notice in your book you list the top 10. Tell us a little bit about what these are.
Yeah, well, basically there's an expression, it's a great term, which is called a core limiting belief. So a core limiting belief is essentially a story that we will tell ourselves that will get in the way or sabotage what it is we profess to want. So, for example, if I had a core limiting belief that I was just not good in front of people, every time I got in front of people to speak, I'd need to go to the bathroom, my palms would get sweaty, I'd start to mumble over my words, blah, blah, blah. Or if I had a core limiting belief that I'm shy, every time I go to a cocktail party, I would go and stand in the corner. So a core limiting belief is pilot error. It's something we do to ourselves. So when you talk about intention-busting stories, these would be stories that we would make up that would inhibit our ability to get what it is we profess to want. So statements like, it's not possible. I failed at this in the past. It will take too much time. There are too many other things for me to do. It's not realistic. I'm not ready yet. It won't work. These are all stories that we're, in a sense, communicating to ourselves and literally enrolling ourselves to have an exit route from being strong in keeping our aspiration.
So are a lot of those stories that we tell ourselves more unconscious, or is it part of the coaching to have it become more conscious so we could change the story?
That's a good question. Because when I think about the work we do in executive development, the first step is for someone to be conscious. Conscious means I'm aware of the stories that I tell myself that produce my behavior. That's being conscious. Coachable is I have the capacity to shift my stories and literally produce a different outcome. So to the question you asked, are these conscious or are they unconscious? For most people, they are not really walking around all day, unless they're neurotic, thinking about what are the stories they're telling themselves. It's completely on an unconscious level. The goal is to get them to suddenly take it into a realm of consciousness where they can then reprogram themselves. But I think for most people walking around, the idea that I'm just not good enough, I failed at this, they're not going to like me, blah, 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 blah. These are things that, these are like old tapes that have been playing for years. Mm-hmm. And unless somebody really takes the time or allows someone to support them to get clear about what those stories are and the implications, people many times just walk around with blinders on to the time they die. And unfortunately, they get to be right. That's the problem.
Yeah, I know.
Now,
it sounds like these obviously are self-sabotaging tapes that are going on in their head. Now, for much of these, are these things that for many of them, they're going back to childhood? Are these tapes that maybe many of us have heard, it's been passed down by a parent or someone in a position of authority?
Yeah, I think all of the above. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I think of my mom's 84 years old, and I remember to this day, when I was in the fourth grade, I was kind of traumatized about math. I forget what it was, maybe, basic math or whatever, geometry maybe. So to make a long story short, whenever it would be time to go for a test in math, I would start getting a stomach ache, and I would try to induce my mother some type of guilt so she'd let me stay home in bed when I was, you know, whatever, 11, 12 years old. So my mother used to say to me this line. I had a friend named Alan Turner, and I had a friend named Mark Zimmer, and she used to say to me, if Zimmer can do it and Turner can do it, Gutman can do it too. I mean, I remember that. Those were her lines back then. I will tell you, from then, which is, you know, 45 years ago to now, the fact of the matter is that statement around the fact that if Turner can do it and Zimmer can do it, Gutman can do it too, mm-hmm. I've always had, she's always given me this sense of belief in myself. And so what it manifested for me throughout my career was this fundamental belief that I could accomplish things. Now, you juxtaposition that with actually somebody that I'm working with right now, a client. He is the president of a particular company, so obviously this guy has made it in people's minds. And from the time he was a kid, he basically got the message from his father that he was never good enough. He was never powerful enough, because his father was very successful. He would never measure up to his dad. So even though this guy has attained success on paper, monetarily, based on what anyone would look at objectively, to this day, this 49-year-old guy does not feel good about himself. And rather than enjoy the fruits of his labor, it's never enough for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm saying that would be a great example whereby this guy is still a prisoner of these stories that were programmed into him, and he has never been powerful enough or conscious enough to be able to, you know, from an exorcist standpoint, you know, get them gone.
Mm-hmm. And it amazes me, because there's so many people that come into my practice with those same tapes, those same messages over and over again, and we spend a lot of time trying to help them, as you say, exercise them so they can move on. And some people are so successful in spite of it, and they still don't acknowledge the fact of their successes because they still feel like they're a failure or won't be good enough.
Right.
And that's exactly right.
That's right.
Exactly right.
And let me ask a question of both of you. I think you could both probably answer this, but I mean, give some examples on how you can, you know, exercise these things out. In other words, how can you readjust those tapes to get, in this case, somebody who you said is 49 years old, to change the tape or to get rid of the old tape? What are some of the techniques that everybody else out there that's listening can, you know, can say, okay, yeah, I think I can, you know, I think I'm in that position also. Give us some examples.
Sure. So in working with this guy, the once he became clear regarding this story, what I then worked with him on was, what were the payoffs? In other words, what was he gaining by holding on to the story and not choosing to let it go?
Mm-hmm.
Now, his initial reaction was, what do you mean? You know, I don't want to have that. I said, well, look, obviously you are holding on to this, so you're gaining something from it. So one of the things that in his mind he said he gained was that he already assumed he would not do good enough. So it took, he let himself off the hook, if you follow me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We then worked on, what was it costing him to hold on to these stories? Because it's not free, right? There's a yin-yang to it. So if some of the payoffs he had was that he never had to, set the bar too high. The price was that he felt this incredible feeling of frustration, this feeling of not being good enough, not feeling happy about himself. So the then question was, what would a replacement story look like? In other words, if he was going to choose to create a different life, a different level of intention, what could he replace the current core limiting belief or intention busting story with? What would be able to be motivational for him?
Mm-hmm.
What would spur him on? So net-net, when you're really working with someone at a very practical level, step one is to have them be clear around their story. Step two is to have them become clear around what's the payoff to hold on to the story. Step three is, what is the story costing them? And finally, step four is, what would the replacement story be? Mm-hmm. And then finally, the way you land the plane is then you have to start thinking about what will be the alternative behaviors someone will now be stepping into in order to manifest that. That's how you create a new intention.
Yeah, and also, I mean, to go back to your book, too, Coach Yourself to Win, you talk about wanting to change the behavior. So, and you also talked about a little bit about the pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, and maintenance stages of changing the behavior. At what point do you think that this client needs to be in order to change the behavior?
I'm sorry, I missed that. Say that question one more time.
Well, you were talking in your book, Coach Yourself to Win, you were talking about the pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, and maintenance stages
right.
to change the behavior.
Right.
At what stage would this client or family members or other people reading the book, would they need to be in it in order to start creating that change of behavior?
They would have to be, it's funny, I don't remember exactly the stages by heart, but what I would say to you is that they have to be already in a place of, at very least, they have got to be conscious, right? That's a given.
Mm-hmm.
They've got to be at least, as we put the term would be, consciously incompetent,
okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
They'd have to be consciously incompetent, with the goal being to then move into what you would call conscious competence.
Mm-hmm.
The discomfort zone is between those two places. So conscious competence, in other words, this is what it looks like. These are the behaviors. To at least have a picture of what that means, that's really what starts the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think I'd like to add to that as well is what is the real story? Because I think in many cases, these people are playing a tape, or we all are to a certain degree, we're playing a tape of what we believe happened, you know, and we believe that we are incompetent because, but what really happened? Okay, you really weren't incompetent, or you really have grown to be much more successful than, in your case, than the father. So I think
right.
also to go back to what is the real story? Well, the real story is maybe you had a very insecure father. And
exactly.
You know,
he was projecting his own stuff.
Exactly, and he's projecting his
exactly.
own stuff, and it really has nothing to do with you. You're actually a very dynamic, successful person that is being affected by a story that isn't even real.
And it's
that's
not
exactly
your story.
Right.
And it's not your story. It's somebody else's. Exactly.
That's exactly right. You just, that's right. And you chose to borrow it.
Yep.
Right.
And own it. That's exactly right.
So
go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Please finish.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was just wondering, based on that stories, but in your observation, what do you think keeps people from changing their story, their behaviors that they know are hurtful to their family?
Because I think it's very, because you're in a comfortable place. It's a very, very comfortable place to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's known, right? There's
mm-hmm.
no doubt in my mind. I kind of get the game, and even if the game isn't something that I necessarily feel happy about,
mm-hmm.
there's a certain security knowing, or certain certainty knowing what the dynamics are.
Yeah.
So going back to the earlier conversation when I said about, with an example, with my sister, I remember having an issue with my sister and I would now and then, you know, clash. Years ago, I actually did set that up where we did go to dinner, and we created a different level of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember at the time, the big risk for her, which she communicated to me, was that, she didn't want to be disappointed. So there was a certain fear. There was a certain, I mean, it sounds strange in a way, but there was a certain, comfort level in having an expectation that her needs would not get met in our sibling relationship. She was scared to put herself out there on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
that's what happens with a lot of folks. You know, it's a fear of being vulnerable.
Oh, yeah.
And another way you could put it, it's a fear of losing control.
Well,
right?
I agree with that. When you're talking about that, I was thinking about in my early 20s, I did that with my biological father because we had our relationship growing up, but it wasn't the ideal relationship by any means. So
right.
in my early 20s,
right.
I actually took him to dinner after I was working at CBS and making enough money to take him to dinner. So I was taking
right.
him to dinner, and I had to reestablish our relationship and ask a bunch of questions and say, this is I want an adult relationship with you now. I know I'm your daughter, but, you know, that relationship wasn't a good fit. So how can I be your daughter as an adult at this point in our life and have a good relationship? And from that point on, it developed into a really great relationship. But, you know, up to that point, I had to do kind of like with your sister. It's like there was some, it was not a good father-daughter match.
Right. How did he hear that at the time?
He actually was pretty open to it, but he wasn't too sure because he wasn't too sure as a father either. So he didn't know his role or what he's supposed to do or not do. So, you know, he took it, and I actually got some questions answered. I didn't really talk to him for a couple of years, and I had to develop that trust in him. So I gave him, I gave him tasks, so to speak, or I gave him opportunities to be able to follow through and actually say what he means and means what he says and be able to trust him again and to develop that trust. And that took some years, but that first conversation to make a change or a shift in that dynamic was huge, because we could have gone on and not had a good relationship all those years, or we could take that, you know, as in this book, or sit there and talk to your family members and say, look, I don't like the way our dynamics are going, it's not working for the family, and I'd really like to have a better relationship and get to know you as an individual and as a person. How can we make those changes?
And Howard, before we go to break, you mentioned a little bit about, you said, you know, your sister had talked about maybe having to come over, overcome her fear, you know, or what she had to lose. Touch on a little bit the fear of the person that has to initiate this, because I think that is the key now, is it's the person that has to initiate it. And what are some of the fears we have to come to get over to actually be that person?
Yeah, well, I think one of the key ones, because I remember the time for myself, was this feeling, this fear of being rejected. You know, I was like, I'm making this overture. How could it be, how would it be possible on any level for her not to want more of a relationship like we have when we were kids? But in fact, there was a little part of me that wasn't sure if she wanted to go there. So I think the issue of being rejected, of being vulnerable, of putting yourself out there on the line and then having somebody not accept that invitation, I think for a lot of people, that's, you know, that's very painful, because all of a sudden you're no longer in the area of not knowing. Now you know.
Yeah.
You know, you're not living in the world of possibilities anymore. That, to me, is probably the fear that stops most people from going there.
And I think what's important, at least it was for me, is that, well, I didn't like the way it was going, so what do I have to lose?
Exactly right.
It's either going to change, or it may have an opportunity to get better.
Well, exactly. And if it doesn't change, you don't have a relationship. And if you approach it and they don't want to, you don't have a relationship. So you're right. I mean, there's really nothing to lose and everything to gain to take that risk at that time in your life.
So to you know, get your book, Coach Yourself to Win, it really, all the steps that you have in there really can apply to family life. But I know we have to take a break real quick, so if you don't mind standing by, we'll be back in just a moment with more to Answers for the Family and our guest today, author Howard Gutman.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we are back to more Answers for the Family. I am your co-host, Dr. Melody Fox, along with Alan Cardoza. And today our guest is the author of Coach Yourself to Win, 7 Steps to Breakthrough Performance on the Job and in Your Life. And we're talking about how to make those steps and take those into your family life as well. And our guest today is the author, Howard M. Gutman. So welcome back to Answers for the Family after a quick break. And Mr. Gutman, we do have a few listener questions. We do like to have our guests emailing questions for our guests coming up, and one of them says that one of the hot topics in the self-improvement sector is intention setting and to achieve personal and professional goals. So how does your method differ from all the rest, or does it?
And Howard, are you back with us?
Yes, I am. Sorry about that.
There you go. We missed the first
one. I was listening to the show. I forgot I was on. yes, it differs. There's at least one significant way that it differs. And this process, you have to go public. The goal here is to solicit input from folks versus in professional development or in personal growth books. Someone can read the book, and it becomes a secret whether or not they're doing anything with it. In our process, once you are clear on your intention, the goal is then to create what we call a circle of support. Mm-hmm. Maybe 2 or 3 people will become your, let's say they have skin in the game to have you succeed, and you literally solicit input from people, so it becomes public, with the rationale being that, again, going back to executive coaching in the corporate sector, the more public you are, it increases the likelihood of success. So in executive coaching, if you were hiring me to be your coach, we would think about who would be certain relevant stakeholders in your universe that we would solicit input from. So let's say, Alan, if you wanted to get to the next level of whatever it is in the radio station, we would be looking at maybe, in addition to Melody, maybe other colleagues, other people in administration, and we'd be soliciting input from them. Then I would come up with a summary statement, and I would give it to you. And then we would start the coaching, enabling you to be better in how you influence, how do you manage differences, whatever it is. So what I'm talking about here is that the goal is to solicit input from this circle of support, and based on the input, that's what creates the game plan. So it's the going public, which is a huge distinction.
Well, in going public, too, and I understand right. The executive area, but in the family, going public, do you mean just the other family members, or are you talking about extended family or friends of the family, or how public do you get in making those changes in the family?
We're talking about the fact that the other members of the family, again, I don't mean everybody in the family, but at least 2 or 3 or whatever, are aware of what you're up to.
Okay.
And, you know, going even further, you might solicit input from them and say, look, in the past, my relationship with so-and-so was never the best. I really want to make a change. Based on what you've observed, what is it that you think I should do differently? Or what part do you think I've contributed in creating the breakdown? Mm-hmm. And if you're suggesting something that would enable me to succeed right now, what would be those behaviors that, in your mind, you would offer up?
Well, and it sounds and, all... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. The last point I was simply going to say, Alan, is I would then say, look, periodically, I'm going to be doing this. When you observe me doing what it is you think I should be doing, please give me a heads up. I'd appreciate it. And if you feel like I'm going off the rails, let me know that as well. So you're showing up as an invitation to be coached.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it sounds like what we're also talking about, or what you're also talking about, is accountability. I think from the standpoint of putting it out there, depending on how public it may be, but once it's out there, I think it's a whole lot more difficult for those that might, shift their focus and just kind of go, okay, well, I can let that go. I think once you've put it out there, there's something about us and our word that says we're going to complete that.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. That's what I meant by the going public aspect of it, Alan.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're out there on the line. It's visible. So that's why when I think about the executive coaching that we do in companies, and going back to Melody's question, the fact of the matter is that in a lot of people who, whether they want to stop drinking or stop smoking or losing weight, whatever it is, and they read whatever books they want to read, it's the unwillingness to go public which allows people to feel like it's safe to be let off the hook and create an exit route for themselves and not follow through. Mm-hmm. When you go public, I'm not saying it's a guarantee, but it absolutely increases the likelihood that you'll be more inclined to stay the course.
That makes perfect sense. Now, we have another listener question that has come in. This one says, I've been seeing a career coach for about a year now, and although the process seems to have some positive effects, it has not really been all that effective for me. It says, my question for you is, how much of this is me? How much of it is my coach? Or could it just be not a good fit?
Well, that's interesting. It's a good question. When you look at executive coaching, whatever the coaching is, there are essentially four aspects that contribute to working or not. The first one is having data. In other words, having a picture of what the finish line needs to look like. So in the case of career coaching, it would be, I have a picture of what my aspirations are, what the job looks like, blah, 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 blah. The second aspect is that there is a simpatico between the coachee and the person coaching them. The third is that there is somebody in a position to observe how the individual is doing and provide them with feedback. Finally, the fourth is the willingness of the person to go beyond their comfort zone. So I can't make a, you know, obviously an abject statement regarding right. in this situation who owns what. But it is fair to say that if it's not working for you, you own a piece of that. So the question I would have you think about is, what part do you play in getting in the way of this engagement with this career coach working for you? That would be the most powerful question to initially start from.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we have another question then that also came in.
Right.
Again from a listener, and this one says, I was excited to read about your book and that you were going to be on this show. I am looking forward to learning how the same set of principles you use in the business world would also apply to helping my family. Can you elaborate more on this?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, going back to what we talked about, the steps are around determining coachability, determining attention, creating your circle of support, collecting data, asking questions, coming up with a game plan, and then having that circle of support provide you with feedback and calibrating. So it would be the exact same process applied to the family that would be applied in the book. The other caveat I would say, though, which is worth noting, is that remember that in the business world, you are paid to succeed. You are literally paid for the coaching to work. The challenge in the personal world is you have to believe that you're being paid to have your relationship work. I know that sounds weird in a way, but the fact of the matter is, in the business world, there's a stake in the ground. You have to be productive, or you can't be dysfunctional, or eventually they'll get rid of you. So in the family situation, you have to have that same mentality that you literally are getting, you know, however you want to put paid might not be the right word, but you have to feel like there isn't an option but to make this thing work. That'd probably be the best way to put it.
Well, and I think there is a payoff, too, and you have to say the reward is I'm going to have a much better functioning family, a lot less dysfunctional, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, that's exactly right. But you have to feel like it's not an option to backslide.
Right.
Right, and if you have anybody out there that thinks that they're not getting paid, just take a look at the divorce rate.
That's exactly right. You know, that's a great point, because you know what's interesting is that if you look at the people who stay married versus the people that get divorced, there's only one distinction. It's not as if the people who get divorced have big issues and the people who stay married have little issues. Right? That's not it.
Right.
It's just that the people who stay married have a story called, it's not an option for me to leave.
Mm-hmm.
The people who get divorced have a story called, you know, there's an exit route. It is nothing more than that.
I like
it
how
literally
you put that.
Is nothing more than that.
Yeah, I'm working with a lot of couples that are on the verge of divorce and deciding whether or not they want to stay married. It's like, well, is that even an option to divorce? And if it is, then what's the payoff for you to stay together?
Exactly.
Right. And at the same thing, if you don't fix these problems, why do you think you're not going to have them in the next relationship?
You know, it's that
concept of, well, you know, this isn't working. I'm going to go find greener pastures. Well, you know what? It isn't always greener out there. And if you never fix it, guess what? You'll probably, the common denominator in the next relationship will be you, no matter what.
That's exactly right. It's funny when you look at people like, you know, say Elizabeth Taylor, she's passed away, but she married 7 or 8 times.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Always trying to find like Mr. Right. You know, it's just at a certain point, Mickey Rooney, mm-hmm. at a certain point you would think that someone would begin to like self-reflect that, there's a consistent pattern here. You know, I wonder what part I play in that. I mean, you think.
Well, and it goes to a favorite line of a song by James Taylor, "Lessons learned are like bridges burned. You only need to cross them but once."
Oh, that's a great line. Yeah. What song is that from?
Or actually, I'm sorry, it was Dan Fogelberg. Those are two of my favorite artists. I get them confused all the time.
Fogelberg,
but
yeah.
"Lessons Learned" is the name of the song, mm-hmm. and I love that line, and I share that a lot with my clients because
that's
if you don't
line.
Learn the lesson, you have to keep going over the bridge.
That's right.
Yeah. So, you know, could you please repeat that? I'm gonna write that down. What is that line again?
"Lessons learned are like bridges burned."
Lessons learned are like, did you say bridges burned?
Bridges burned. You only need to cross them but once.
That's a great line.
It's from the "Lessons Learned" song by Dan Fogelberg.
Oh, good.
So, Anyway, you know, I'm dating myself here, the 70s.
No, that's okay. And that's two really great poets, you know. So.
Dan Fogelberg, was that higher than, blah, 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 right? Was
yeah,
that
longer
yep.
than, yep. Okay,
yep.
Well,
we can all,
you're talking to an ex-radio DJ, so it's like we could talk about music
okay.
all you
yeah,
want.
Well,
but.
I'm a movie TV trivia guy, music too.
Well, actually, when you're talking about TV and all that, you know, are there any TV shows or movies that you've seen that utilize these coaching or changing the dynamics in the families, or does everybody need some coaching in the TV shows?
That's an interesting metaphor. Let me think now. Well, you know, you could say, actually, you know, there's a bit of reach, like, you know, Casablanca.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? You could say that ultimately the fact that Rick Humphrey Bogart's character chose a different intention and let go of Ingrid Bergman, Ilsa, even though he was in love with her, because he felt like there was a bigger game afoot. Right? If you mm-hmm. saw Casablanca.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh, absolutely.
That's, I think, a very good metaphor.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that is good.
For those people in the audience who are conscious enough of the movie to get that metaphor. But yeah. I'm happy I said it, frankly.
Oh, well, I am too. Well,
that's a good question.
Well, I'm just curious, too. Feedback is often difficult to give in a family situation. So how do you give the feedback without hurting others? And I'm going to parlay that into another part is, you mentioned your book, Active Listening. Does that correlate with that, of getting feedback?
Yeah. The key in feedback is you've got to give it in a way that is depersonalized. It's got to be about behavior. So what you don't want to do is label somebody. So in other words, going back to that thing with my sister, if I was talking to my mother about it, and I said to my mother, so what do you think I'm doing that's creating this rift between me and so-and-so? And she says, well, I see that sometimes you bust her chops, or you don't acknowledge her, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in providing feedback, if my mother said to me, now those were all behavioral examples.
Mm-hmm.
If my mother said to me, well, sometimes you're really nasty and you don't acknowledge her, or sometimes I see you being very cruel and very mean. Mm-hmm. As soon as she starts putting a label on me, I start getting my cackles up.
Mm-hmm.
So the point here is to focus on the behaviors you want changed, not to label them, not to judge the individual. That would be a real distinction in providing high-quality feedback versus dysfunctional. To the second point that you asked regarding active listening is essentially holding up a mirror to what it is you see. So saying things like, the message I'm hearing is blah, blah, blah. What I'm hearing you say is such and such. It sounds to me like you know, blah, blah, blah. So what you're doing is you're holding up a mirror. You're making observations about what you're hearing somebody say. That's active listening. Versus you're disagreeing, you're agreeing, you are debating, you are justifying. What you're doing in listening is you are processing the other individual so that they're clear, that you are clear regarding what it is they said. Mm-hmm. That'd probably be the easiest way to describe it.
Yeah, and I think that makes good sense. And when you were first talking about as far as feedback and such, the thought crossed my mind that I think one of the biggest mistakes people make, as you said in regards to labeling it, is they'll
right.
go, but you always do this, or you never do this.
Right.
And then we're so far off the topic of what the action or the activity was, we're not focused on that. Now it becomes a personal attack because you always do this, or you never do this.
Exactly.
And yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and I think it's just one of those unfortunate traps that many people fall in.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, which is why, you know, when you think about executive coaching, it's kind of like ironic. When we do executive coaching, the heavy lifting is on the back of the executive coach to some degree, right? Because I'm the one who's collecting the data for the individual. I'm the one who's coming back with the summary.
Mm-hmm.
Then I work with them to go back to the people that I interviewed to convey, to thank them and convey messages and blah, blah, blah. When you're doing the self-coaching, it requires almost like a higher degree of sophistication because you're the one who's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you consider that we're talking now about the family, where there's even a higher level of intimacy, right? It's more of a three-dimensional game. The key is that in order for someone to do this, the price of admission is that they've got to be okay. They've got to be okay. They cannot be thin-skinned, defensive, and screwed up, even though it's very judgmental to say that. But they need to come from a healthy place. They another way to put it is that they literally have to see the feedback as a gift,
mm-hmm.
not as a threat. So in order to do self-coaching, particularly with the family, the fact of the matter is that an individual has got to be in a good place about who they are.
Well, it's almost like when you're doing the executive coaching, you're the middleman. So you're the messenger of what you hear. And when you're in the family, you're the recipient and you are the messenger.
Right.
And you're the listener. And, you know, and I was also thinking, too, about not only do you have to be in kind of a safe place and not personalize everything, but the family, you know, how willing are they to take what you're saying that you want to do, and how willing will they need to be to order to give you that feedback in a positive way so they aren't getting reactive?
That's right.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it does require that the people you're dealing with, their head is on essentially pretty straight.
Yeah, and I think it's a really great point because you have one of two different directions in which they could go, and you have the one type of person that is the yes person that just says, oh, you know, whatever you say that you want them to give you an honest opinion of, they come with something of, you know, oh, but you know, you're great and you're wonderful, and they just kind of yes you, so you don't really make any progress, or then the other person seizes the opportunity. You know, the person on the other end of the spectrum could seize the opportunity to kind of dump on you. Well, yeah, that's right.
Right.
And that's why I'm going through this. And all of a sudden, they're making it about them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that Melody brings up a great point is that not only do you have to be of pretty sound mind and willingness, but so does the people that you're entrusting and being vulnerable with.
That's exactly right. Exactly.
Now, once you achieve that and you're making those changes, I know in your book you talk about, you know, getting there and staying there. Talk about the need to reassess what you're doing.
Yeah, what that would mean is that at a certain point, you'd want to convene. I don't want to get that professional. At some point, you'd want to get together again with, you know, again, when I use the example of the sister,
mm-hmm.
and say, look, why don't we get together, you know, a couple of months from now and, you know, I'd like some feedback. Like, how do you think it's working? So you're periodically reassessing. You're periodically calibrating just to make sure that things are cool. That's the really the point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No different than in the corporate sector. I mean, I'm at a corporation today in D.C., and tomorrow I'll be with a colleague of mine working with the senior executive team.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw them about 5 months ago, and what we're doing is we reassess them periodically to look at how the team is tracking in terms of clarity of roles, goals, who's doing what to whom, is the game working properly, conflict resolution, blah, 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 blah. That's what we do. So the need to reassess versus assuming that, you know, we're going to rejigger our relationship and then we're okay forevermore is, you know, it's not real.
Right. So it's about reassessing to make sure you're still continuing towards that happy ending.
That's exactly right. That's exactly the way to put it.
And talking about happy endings, unfortunately, we are at the ending here. But our guest today is Howard Gutman. Thank you so much for being with us today. If people want,
it was fun.
If people want to get your book, Coach Yourself to Win, 7 Steps to Breakthrough Performance on the Job and in Your Life, where do they get it?
They can go to either one of the two places, the three. They can go to either the CoachYourselfToWin.com, which is a site devoted to the book. They could go to our website, which is GutmanDev.com. That's GutmanDev.com. Or they can go to Amazon.
Okay.
That sounds great. Howard,
that's
again.
That's the story.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us. And for everybody out there, if you were driving and you couldn't write those things down, you can always go to our website, answers4thefamilyblog.com. Send us the question. We will forward it on to Howard. And again, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Take care.
All right.
Have a great day.
Bye.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.